Chapter 60. Have crossed the frontier. We shall have a quiet dinner. George accepted the invitation, although his wife was a little ailing. They were now not quite 6 weeks married. Another woman was laughing or sneering at her expense, and he not angry. He was not even angry with himself, this good-natured fellow. It is a shame, he owned to himself. But hang it, if a pretty woman will throw herself in your way, why, what can a fellow do, you know? I am rather free about women, he had often said, smiling and nodding knowingly to Stubble and Spoony, and other comrades of the mess table, and they rather respected him than otherwise for this prowess. Next to conquering in war, conquering in love has been a source of pride, time out of mind, amongst men in Vanity Fair, or how should schoolboys brag of their amours, or Don Juan be popular? So Mr. Osborne, having a firm conviction in his own mind, that he was a woman-killer and destined to conquer, did not run counter to his fate, but yielded himself up to it quite complacently. And as Emmy did not say much, or plague him with her jealousy, but merely became unhappy, and pined over it miserably in secret, he chose to fancy that she was not suspicious of what all his acquaintance were perfectly aware, namely, that he was carrying on a desperate flirtation with Mrs. Crawley. He rode with her whenever she was free. He pretended regimental business to Amelia, by which falsehood she was not in the least deceived, and consigning his wife to solitude, or her brother's society, passed his evenings in the Crawleys' company, losing money to the husband and flattering himself that the wife was dying of love for him. It is very likely that this worthy couple never absolutely conspired, and agreed together in so many words. The one to cajole the young gentleman, whilst the other won his money at cards. But they understood each other perfectly well, and Rawdon let Osborne come and go with entire good humor. George was so occupied with his new acquaintances, that he and William Dobbin were by no means so much together as formerly. George avoided him in public, and in the regiment, and, as we see, did not like those sermons which his senior was disposed to inflict upon him. If some parts of his conduct made Captain Dobbin exceedingly grave and cool, of what use was it to tell George that, though his whiskers were large, and his own opinion of his knowingness great, he was as green as a schoolboy? That Rawdon was making a victim of him as he had done of many before, and as soon as he had used him would fling him off with scorn? He would not listen. And so, as Dobbin, upon those days when he visited the Osborne house, seldom had the advantage of meeting his old friend, much painful and unavailing talk between them was spared. Our friend George was in the full career of the pleasures of Vanity Fair. There never was, since the days of Darius, such a brilliant train of camp followers as hung round the Duke of Wellington's army in the Low Countries, in 1815. And led it dancing and feasting, as it were, up to the very brink of battle. A certain ball which a noble duchess gave at Brussels on the 15th of June in the above-named year is historical. All Brussels had been in a state of excitement about it, and I have heard from ladies who were in that town at the period, that the talk and interest of persons of their own sex regarding the ball was much greater even than in respect of the enemy in their front. The struggles, intrigues, and prayers to get tickets were such as only English ladies will employ, in order to gain admission to the society of the great of their own nation. Joe's and Mrs. O'Dowd, who were panting to be asked, strove in vain to procure tickets, but others of our friends were more lucky. For instance, through the interest of my Lord Barrister's, and as a set-off for the dinner at the Restaurateur's, George got a card for Captain and Mrs. Osborne, which circumstance greatly elated him. Dobbin, who was a friend of the general commanding the division in which their regiment was, came laughing one day to Mrs. Osborne, and displayed a similar invitation, which made Joe's envious, and George wonder how the deuce he should be getting into society. Mr. and Mrs. Rawdon, finally, were of course invited, as became the friends of a general commanding a cavalry brigade. On the appointed night, George, having commanded new dresses and ornaments of all sorts for Amelia, drove to the famous ball, where his wife did not know a single soul. After looking about for Lady Barrisers, who cut him, thinking the card was quite enough, and after placing Amelia on a bench, he left her to her own cogitations there, thinking, on his own part, that he had behaved very handsomely in getting her new clothes, and bringing her to the ball, where she was free to amuse herself as she liked. Her thoughts were not of the pleasantest, and nobody except honest Dobbin came to disturb them. Whilst her appearance was an utter failure, as her husband felt with a sort of rage, Mrs. Rawdon Crawley's debut was, on the contrary, very brilliant. She arrived very late. Her face was radiant, her dress perfection. In the midst of the great persons assembled, and the eyeglasses directed to her, Rebecca seemed to be as cool and collected as when she used to marshal Miss Pinkerton's little girls to church. Numbers of the men she knew already, and the dandies thronged round her. As for the ladies, it was whispered among them that Rawdon had run away with her from out of a convent, and that she was a relation of the Montmorency family. She spoke French so perfectly that there might be some truth in this report, and it was agreed that her manners were fine, and her air distinct. 50 would-be partners thronged round her at once, and pressed to have the honor to dance with her. But she said she was engaged, and only going to dance very little, and made her way at once to the place, where Emmy sate quite unnoticed, and dismally unhappy. And so, to finish the poor child at once, Mrs. Rawdon ran and greeted affectionately her dearest Amelia, and began forthwith to patronize her. She found fault with her friend's dress, and her hairdresser, and wondered how she could be so chaussy, and vowed that she must send her curtsy the air the next morning. She vowed that it was a delightful ball, that there was everybody that everyone knew, and only a very few nobodies in the whole room. It is a fact, that in a fortnight, and after three dinners in general society, this young woman had got up the genteel jargon so well, that a native could not speak it better. And it was only from her French being so good, that you could know she was not a born woman of fashion. George, who had left Emmy on her bench on entering the ballroom, very soon found his way back, when Rebecca was by her dear friend's side. Becky was just lecturing Mrs. Osborne upon the follies which her husband was committing. "For God's sake, stop him from gambling, my dear," she said, "or he will ruin himself. He and Rawdon are playing at cards every night, and you know he is very poor, and Rawdon will win every shilling from him, if he does not take care. Why don't you prevent him, you little careless creature? Why don't you come to us of an evening, instead of moping at home with that Captain Dobbin? I dare say he is tressaimable, but how could one love a man with feet of such size? Your husband's feet are darlings, here he comes. Where have you been, wretch? Here is Emmy crying her eyes out for you. Are you coming to fetch me for the quadrille?" And she left her bouquet and shawl by Amelia's side, and tripped off with George to dance. Women only know how to wound so. There is a poison on the tips of their little shafts, which stings a thousand times more than a man's blunter weapon. Our poor Emmy, who had never hated, never sneered all her life, was powerless in the hands of her remorseless little enemy. George danced with Rebecca twice or thrice, how many times Amelia scarcely knew. She sat quite unnoticed in her corner, except when Rawdon came up with some words of clumsy conversation. And later in the evening, when Captain Dobbin made so bold as to bring her refreshments and sit beside her, he did not like to ask her why she was so sad. But as a pretext for the tears which were filling in her eyes, she told him that Mrs. Crawley had alarmed her by telling her that George would go on playing. It is curious, when a man is bent upon play, by what clumsy rogues he will allow himself to be cheated, Dobbin said. And Emmy said, indeed. She was thinking of something else. It was not the loss of the money that grieved her. At last George came back for Rebecca's shawl and flowers. She was going away. She did not even condescend to come back and say goodbye to Amelia. The poor girl let her husband come and go without saying a word, and her head fell on her breast. Dobbin had been called away, and was whispering deep in conversation with the general of the division, his friend, and had not seen this last parting. George went away then with a bouquet, but when he gave it to the younger, there lay a note, coiled like a snake among the flowers. Rebecca's eye caught it at once, as he had been used to deal with notes in early life. She put out her hand, and took the nosegay. He saw by her eyes as they met, that she was aware what she should find there. Her husband hurried her away, still too intent upon his own thoughts, seemingly, to take note of any marks of recognition which might pass between his friend and his wife. These were, however, but trifling. Rebecca gave George her hand with one of her usual quick knowing glances, and made a curtsy and walked away. George bowed over the hand, said nothing in reply to a remark of Crawley's, did not hear it even, his brain was so throbbing with triumph and excitement, and allowed them to go away without a word. His wife saw the one part at least of the bouquet scene. It was quite natural that George should come at Rebecca's request to get her her scarf and flowers. It was no more than he had done 20 times before in the course of the last few days, but now it was too much for her. W. William, she said, suddenly clinging to Dobbin, who was near her, you've always been very kind to me, I'm not well. Take me home. She did not know she called him by his Christian name, as George was accustomed to do. He went away with her quickly. Her lodgings were hard by, and they threaded through the crowd without, where everything seemed to be more astir than even in the ballroom within. George had been angry twice or thrice at finding his wife upon his return from the parties which he frequented. So she went straight to bed now. But although she did not sleep, and although the din and clatter, and the galloping of horsemen were incessant, she never heard any of these noises, having quite other disturbances to keep her awake. Osborne meanwhile, wild with elation, went off to a play table, and began to bet frantically. He won repeatedly. Everything succeeds with me tonight, he said. But his luck at play even did not cure him of his restlessness, and he started up after a while, pocketing his winnings, and went to a buffet, where he drank off many bumpers of wine. Here, as he was rattling away to the people around, laughing loudly and wild with spirits, Dobbin found him. He had been to the card tables to look there for his friend. Dobbin looked as pale and grave as his comrade was flushed and jovial. Hello, Dob. Come and drink, old Dob. The Duke's wine is famous. Give me some more, you sir, and he held out a trembling glass for the liquor. Come out, George, said Dobbin, still gravely. Don't drink. Drink. There's nothing like it. Drink yourself, and light up your lantern jaws, old boy. Here's to you. Dobbin went up and whispered something to him, at which George, giving a start and a wild hooray, tossed off his glass, clapped it on the table, and walked away speedily on his friend's arm. The enemy has passed the Sambre, William said, and our left is already engaged. Come away. We are to march in 3 hours. Away went George, his nerves quivering with excitement at the news so long looked for, so sudden when it came. What were love and intrigue now? He thought about 1,000 things, but these in his rapid walk to his quarters, his past life and future chances, the fate which might be before him, the wife, the child perhaps, from whom unseen he might be about to part. Oh, how he wished that night's work undone, and that with a clear conscience at least he might say farewell to the tender and guileless being by whose love he had set such little store. He thought over his brief married life. In those few weeks he had frightfully dissipated his little capital. How wild and reckless he had been. Should any mischance befall him? What was then left for her? How unworthy he was of her. Why had he married her? He was not fit for marriage. Why had he disobeyed his father, who had been always so generous to him? Hope, remorse, ambition, tenderness, and selfish regret filled his heart. He sat down and wrote to his father, remembering what he had said once before when he was engaged to fight a duel. Dawn faintly streaked the sky as he closed his farewell letter. He sealed it and kissed the superscription. He thought how he had deserted that generous father, and of the thousand kindnesses which the stern old man had done him. He had looked into Amelia's bedroom when he entered. She lay quiet, and her eyes seemed closed, and he was glad that she was asleep. On arriving at his quarters from the ball, he had found his regimental servant already making preparations for his departure. The man had understood his signal to be still, and these arrangements were very quickly and silently made. Should he go in and wake Amelia, he thought, or leave a note for her brother, to break the news of departure to her? He went in to look at her once again. As he had been awake when he first entered her room, but had kept her eyes closed, so that even her wakefulness should not seem to reproach him. But when he had returned, so soon after herself too, this timid little heart had felt more at ease, and turning towards him as he stepped softly out of the room, as he had fallen into a light sleep. George came in and looked at her again, entering still more softly. By the pale night lamp he could see her sweet, pale face. The purple eyelids were fringed and closed, and one round arm, smooth and white, lay outside of the coverlet. Good God! How pure she was! How gentle, how tender, and how friendless! And he, how selfish, brutal, and black with crime! Heart-stained and shame-stricken, he stood at the bed's foot and looked at the sleeping girl. How dared he, who was he, to pray for one so spotless? God bless her! God bless her! He came to the bedside and looked at the hand, the little soft hand, lying asleep. And he bent over the pillow noiselessly towards the gentle pale face. Two fair arms closed tenderly round his neck as he stooped down. "I'm awake, George," the poor child said, with a sob fit to break the little heart that nestled so closely by his own. She was awake, poor soul, and to what? At that moment a bugle from the Place of Arms began sounding clearly, and was taken up through the town. And amidst the drums of the infantry, and the shrill pipes of the Scotch, the whole city awoke. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.